So the work I'm going to present is part of my PhD project, currently under supervision of Professor Renatolo, which is in the audience. And one might ask, so why exactly in a quantum gravity seminar am I talking about classical theories? So the classical action and the models I'm going to study, they are motivated as some hypothetical no-energy limits of a quantum theory of gravity, a proposal for a quantum theory of gravity, namely Ojava-Lifshitz gravity. So this proposal, which I think dates from 2009 by Peter Ojava, in this proposal, the idea is to get a perturbatively renormalizable quantum theory of gravity, where the degrees of freedom that are to be quantized are just the usual metric degrees of freedom, and one ideally not have more than two second order time derivatives to avoid problems with unitarity, ghosts, and so on. So to do so, one sacrifices invariance under four-dimensional diffeomorphisms and imposes a time foliation as a fundamental structure. So the idea is that you have three-dimensional hypersurfaces labeled by a constant time, and while in GR this happens but the foliation is arbitrary, here there is really a notion of time. And as I will explain later, this actually implies that the action will contain terms of higher order in spatial derivatives. But for the classical point of view, at least the one I want to explore today, if we restrict ourselves to the terms in the action which have up to second order derivatives, spatial or otherwise, we don't have the Einstein-Hilbert action. There is at least one extra parameter. So the question I want to try to answer, at least start today, is whether or not we can actually recover general relativity at this classical level. So let me just go through the outline of the talk. And so I'll begin by introducing the Ojava-Lifshitz gravity, just try to explain the general logic behind the construction. We won't go into too many details because for the higher order terms, we won't really need them. And there are several papers on this. And then I'll give a very quick recap to the AVM formulation of gravity, in particular also for the very short review of constraint systems. I apologize for those who have seen this countless times, but just to at least establish some nomenclature and definitions. Anyway, then the focus of the work would be on the Hamiltonian formulation of what I will define later, the lambda R models. And the bulk of the talk we actually dedicated to this section for the non-projectable version, which I'll soon define. There will be a brief comment, just one slide on the projectable side of the theory, and then we'll end with some discussion. So actually the way this theory starts is by trying to define the UV fixed points. So it's sort of inspired by condensed matter systems with Lifshitz type fixed points. And the idea is that deep in the ultraviolet, actually time and space would scale differently. They would scale according to this relation, where for a scaling of B in all the directions, time would actually have a different scaling, which is labeled by this critical exponent Z. Essentially, fixing a Z will determine which model we are addressing. So, in particular, since we will always discuss Z different from one, otherwise this would just be the standard story, this actually implies the preferred notion of time. And to impose that, there is a fundamental notion of a time foliation. So we'll always consider manifolds of the form with the time direction R cross sigma, where sigma for our purposes would be either asymptotically flat, although for most cases it will be just compact. So for all the equations where I have a cosmological constant, if I start talking about asymptotically flat, just assume it's not there, and so that it's not necessary to repeat the equation. In any case, to have a foliation as a fundamental structure, it's necessary to abandon invariance under four-dimensional diffeomorphisms for the simple fact they do not preserve this foliation. And what is done here is to switch to foliation-preserving diffeomorphisms, these guys here. So we have spatial diffeomorphisms on the spatial hypersurface, the normal ones, and we only have time-dependent the foliation reparameterization. So just the time coordinate that labels the foliation can be reparameterized at will. Since we're going to use Hamiltonian formulation and since there is a foliation in place, it's more adequate to actually explore the theory in terms of the AVM decomposition of the metric. So we have the spatial metric, just normal metric on hypersurfaces, the shift vector, and the lapse function. Now, with The idea is then to start constructing some action. And since I said that we're only interested in second order in time derivatives, well, just like in GR, we actually do need laps and shift to construct invariants, because just with G dot, it's not possible. However, because the symmetries are slightly different, they're a smaller group, for all our purposes, it would be completely sufficient to construct the invariants, at least the time parts, to have the laps just a function of time. This will become important later as it gives rise to the two different versions of the theory. Now, if one starts at the ultraviolet regime, well, in special units of special momentum, the time and space scale differently. And to make the line element have some sort of sense, then we have to impose that one of these fields that is not dimensionless. With the usual choice in the literature is the shift vector. And then one constructs the kinetic term of the action as usual, except that because the invariant group is slightly different, there is an extra term appearing already at this stage. So what happens is that in GR, only the combination Kij, Kij minus K square is invariant, whereas because we have foliation preserving diffuse, these two terms are actually independently preserved. And Kij is just the usual extrinsic curvature. Now, the reason I'm plugging all these scaling dimensions here is that, so the idea to obtain perturbative renormalizability would be to have this coupling here, the usual inverse Newton's coupling constant, to be dimensionless. And in D plus one dimensions, turns out that demanding that this thing is dimensionless amounts to setting Z, the exponent we had on the first slide, being equal to the special dimension. And then what one would do normally to construct the potential part of the action, just to include every term with dimension equal to or lower than these ones. And because this term here, or this one alternatively, has a scaling dimension of 2D, or to Z, then what it means is that we'll have up to six order terms in special derivatives. So I'm not going to use pretty much any of them, any of the extra ones. However, just for illustrative purposes, I got a list from a paper of Matt Visser. Well, this is just the sixth order invariants. We have two fourth order and then the usual ones. Now, some other authors also include third and fifth order terms. There are some controversies because of parity violations and so on. But so it's messy. There's a lot of, the action has too many couplings to be workable in general. And it's not really the end of the story. As I said before, the laps can actually be constructed just as a time function of time. And this gives rise to two different versions of the theory. So the first one, and it's the one we're going to dedicate more time talking about today, is the non-projectable version, where the laps is just the usual function of spacetime that we have in GR. However, because the time parameterization is only a function of time, we can also have the so-called projectable Java-Lifshitz gravity, where the laps is a function of time only. And again, because we have a smaller symmetry group, turns out the acceleration of the Eulerian observer, given here by the derivative of the log of the laps, actually transforms as a vector in the foliation preserving diffuse. And therefore, at least for the non-projectable theory, one should actually include all the invariants built out of these terms, which makes it even messier than it already was with all the terms I mentioned before. Now, however, what I wanted to talk about is the classical limit. So let's just take a look at the action built, the most general one we can build with only second order derivatives. So we have the usual Einstein-Hilbert terms plus this constant lambda, and already at the lowest order we have two terms with this acceleration. So in principle, we obtain Einstein-Hilbert if and only if lambda is 1 and beta is 0. And in projectable theory, we can disregard beta because the laps is a function of time. But so our goal would be to study the models described by the action up to here and understand under what conditions, if any, we can actually recover GR for lambda different than 1. So the reason we started doing this was an apparent contradiction that we found in the literature. So before that, actually, the kinetic term that I had here before can be actually encoded in a nicer way. So one can generalize the Wheeler-DeWitt metric, metric on the space of metrics to include the lambda. And it turns out that this little thing is only invertible if lambda is different from 1/3, because at 1/3 there is some extra symmetry and there will be an extra constraint. But so for the rest of the talk, we always assume lambda is different from 1/3, and whenever these kind of terms appear, they usually come from here. But so as I was saying before I messed up my own order, we found some apparently contradictory results. So the first one, and this was actually a paper that came out a lot before Javalifshi, somewhere in the 90s. Julien and Kiefer studied a model where they generalized the Wheeler-DeWitt metric, just the one I had before, and they concluded that it seemed first gravity would not really be attractive if lambda was smaller than 1/3, because the sign of the acceleration of the tree volume would actually change. And then in the same context, they actually pursued and generalized they checked how the tree would behave for FRW solutions, generalized the equations, and got some strong constraints on lambda stemming from cosmological observations. I won't go into detail on that, just would like to mention that the context is exactly the same. However, a bit later, I think 2010, Bellorin Restuccia studied the same theory for the non-projectable case, and they specified asymptotically flat special hypersurfaces. They showed that lambda induces a tertiary constraint, which in the language of the action is the trace of the extrinsic curvature being zero, the so-called maximal slicing condition. And with these constraints, since the lambda is the term that appears on the action proportional to this, well, they actually obtained that the theory would be equivalent to GR in this gauge. So how come there's lambda-dependent quantities here and not here? What we'll hope to show, and then we'll generalize because on the compact, first we'll study the compact case here and show that this is like the happiest of scenarios. Generally, for non-asymptotically flat manifolds, lambda does not really drop out. But these ones are actually would actually be a characteristic feature of the projectable theory. So there it's very straightforward to obtain exactly these results, and so everything else they obtain, all the constraints that they obtain for lambda, should be applicable for the projectable theory only, at least so far. Having said this, let me just briefly review the ADM formulation of gravity, since I'm going to be comparing our models with it all the time. And I will start with the constraint systems part. So just very quick recap, if we have some Lagrangian, so usual functions of position and velocities, we define the momenta. And ideally, what we would like to invert this relation to express the velocities functions of position momentum. This is not always possible, and it's the case in general relativity, especially when the Hessian is not invertible. So what we do then is we take into account the invertible relations that we have. The other ones, which are not independent, they form a set of primary constraints, which we denote by phi being equal to zero. And then we can actually perform the Legendre transformation and write the Hamiltonian, the usual way for the invertible part, and then take into account this set of constraints where these alphas are Lagrange multipliers. So to make the theory consistent, then one has to check that these relations here, phi being equal to zero, are actually consistent with the theory that we have. And for that, we use the Poisson-Brackett structure of the theory. We compute the time evolution of these constraints, and we impose that it's weakly equals zero, where this weakly equal means equal up to a linear combination of constraints. And then there are three options for this equation. Either it's trivial, it's zero, and that's it, fine, it's consistent, or it actually imposes a condition on phase space variables. In that case, this condition, some equation for phase space variables being equal to zero, it's a secondary constraint. If there is some Lagrange multiplier involved, it just determines Lagrange multiplier and we can proceed. Then basically this process is repeated until no new constraints are generated. Once we have all this set of constraints, let's say that we have n of them, we can compute the Poisson bracket among all of them. And the rank of the matrix, denoted by little m, actually allows us to classify the constraints in terms of second class or first class. The rank of m gives us the number of second class constraints, while n minus that gives us the number of first class. So essentially, the first class constraints are those who commute with all the other ones, and the second class constraints, usually in pairs, have something that they don't commute with. In particular, this is useful to determine the number of physical degrees of freedom, which is given just 1/2 and the phase space dimension minus twice the first class constraints and minus the number of second class. So as an example, and now in field theory language, we have GR, where just the action is given very similar to the one we had there, just with traditional Wheeler-DeWitt metric. Here's denoted by this curly G, which is just the one we had at lambda equals 1. And because there are no time derivatives of either laps or shifts, actually the momentum of these quantities define the primary constraints of the theory, while we have a non-vanishing momentum for the metric. Preserving these constraints and performing the first transformation gives us first a total Hamiltonian, where I included again the constraints with Lagrange multipliers. With these two quantities here, usually so-called Hamiltonian constraints and momentum constraints. So this one generates spatial diffuse, whereas this is really the time reparameterizations. And only by preserving these primary ones do we obtain the relation that H has to vanish equally, weakly, and the same thing for HI. And, well, then preserving H and HI is a bit more nasty, but it gives us essentially what the so-called Dirac algebra. And basically, no new constraints are generated. Everything here is either proportional to momentum constraints or to Hamiltonian constraints. So this vanishes on the constraint surface. And in GR, that's the end of the story. Nothing happens. Just as a remark, most of the time I will present Poisson brackets with smeared quantities. So what we do is we smear it with some function eta, and then we read off the time evolution in this way. As we will see, because we have still spatial diffeomorphisms on the theory, this part here will stay the same. I mean, there is nothing that will change in the momentum constraints because we didn't touch spatial diffuse, and therefore this bracket will be completely untouched. There is a change on the Hamiltonian constraints, but it's still a scalar in the spatial diffeomorphisms. Hence, the second bracket will also stay the same, which is this one being generalized, but still proportional to the constraint itself. What will change, however, is this last one, which will give us this piece, will ignore plus an extra piece that's the tertiary constraint that I mentioned before, that for asymptotically flat spaces yields the so-called maximum curve slicing gauge. So let me start with the non-projectable version then. So comparing to what we had in GR, essentially we do the opposite thing we did before. We take the standard Wheeler-DeWitt metric, we replace it with a generalized one, and the momentum definitions are the same primary constraints, and just the Hamiltonian constraint has the lambda dependence encoded here. As I said before, preserving this H constraint is where things get tricky, and for both of our cases, so for asymptotically flat, which had been studied before, and for a compact case, one has this extra piece, which doesn't vanish on the constraint surface. Of course, if lambda is at 1, this thing vanishes as it should. And just as a remark, and to explain why this doesn't happen in the projectable version, this term comes from exclusively the variation of the Ricci scalar term in the Hamiltonian constraints. In particular, it comes from this part here, where I have already smeared the variation with the lapse, because that's how it's going to play out anyway. And it's only the part where the derivatives actually act on the lapse. So if the lapse is a function of time, this term is a total derivative and nothing happens. This doesn't occur in the projectable version. So when I go through the projectable theory and I just say, well, nothing happens after obtaining these constraints, this is exactly why. And well, this looks like a sort of a nasty piece, but this can actually be simplified for both spacetimes we're considering if one assumes that first, square root of g and n, basically we assume that this thing is positive, and then we're fine. We can actually simplify it and write it in this way. So the essentially covariant derivative of the trace of pi, which is essentially the trace of extrinsic curvature, is zero. Now, so this is where they actually obtain the pi equals zero constraints. What happens is that for the asymptotically flat case, pi has to go to zero at spatial infinity. And so tertiary constraints make sure this actually happens at the entire hypersurfaces. And because the total Hamiltonian is quadratic in the trace of pi, then the time evolution of pi doesn't depend on lambda. In fact, it just gives us exactly the same conditions as one would obtain in GR by imposing that this gauge condition would be preserved in time. And therefore, the theory yields GR. However, for the compact case that we studied, the solution for this constraint is actually given by the so-called CMC condition, or the York gauge, probably some other names involved. But essentially tells us that pi, as long as this A is a special constant, any choice is a solution of this equation there. So at this point, we have want to study whether or not lambda will actually influence this, well, with this version here. And well, because pi doesn't vanish in this constraint, the quaternary constraint that we obtain by preserving the pi over square root of g being equal to a will actually depend on lambda. Moreover, the equations of motion, the Hamiltonian, will be all depend on lambda, and so it would be very unlikely that we actually recover gr. So to preserve the constraints I had here before, we actually did two choices for a of t, because just for a general one, I wasn't exactly sure how to proceed. And the first one is just simpler thing, take it as a constant. We have essentially the quaternary constraint we have is a second order differential operator, this one here acting on the lapse giving zero. If we do the same thing in GR, we have the same constraint just with lambda equal to one. Now, while discussing with people from shape dynamics, they mentioned that usually the option they choose for the CMC gauge is actually this one. And so choosing this one, this thing becomes a little better behaved, so we have the same differential operator, but then we have this, the average of itself. And that would be the condition. Now, what we did next was to take the simpler option of constant A, consider initial hypersurface with vanishing Ricci scalar, and integrate this constraint M over this hypersurface. And what we can show is that for lambda lower than 1/3, actually the phase space, the physical phase space, the phase space of solutions is different than the one of GR drastically. So for GR, the A squared term is only restricted by the cosmological constant, and which we assume to be positive for this story. For lambda over 1/3, this relation is slightly modified, but this is still a positive number. For lambda below 1/3, actually any A is allowed. So we can have any sort of relation between the trace of the intrinsic curvature and the determinant of the metric.
Excuse me, can I ask something?
Yeah, sure.
This condition of adding has to be zero.
Sorry?
You're assuming that you have an initial hypersurface.
Yes.
Which has zero extrinsic.
Intrinsic. Curvature. Intrinsic.
Haven't you assumed before that those have zero K?
No. The 0k was only for this entirely flat case. That was a solution that had been studied before. So for our case, only if a is 0 do we have 0k, in which case pretty much nothing happens, just cosmological constant.
And how is the assumption that the intrinsic curvature is 0?
Just as an initial condition. It was just to have an example of cases where if we take the same initial conditions in GR and in this theory, we would have something different. I'm not claiming there is some physical motivation to study this. It was just a simpler example, nothing more.
Is all of this analysis for? Can you remind me one more time? What is the action that you're starting with? Is it the full projectable?
No. It's non-projectable, but it does not have the healthy extension. No.
Doesn't have the acceleration.
So just the lambda term. I would like to afterwards study that, but we begin with this one. So then if we were to compute m dot, and we would get a differential equation for the Lagrange multiplier of the momentum of the lapse, again, we would have a similar one if we were just doing GR and just proceeded blindly with the CMC gauge. However, this equation, which I'm not going to present, I have it here and I can write it down on the board if you want, but it's just a huge equation, depends on lambda in ways. First, just as a remark, now here one could perhaps hope, because this is the way as well that the lambda dependence shows up in the equations of motion. perhaps if we can absorb the lambda into the A or absorb the whole thing as a time sort of time-dependent cosmological constant, we could get away with recovering GR in this gauge. However, the equation that determines the foliation, in particular the equation that determines this alpha here, does not depend on lambda in the same way. So it could be that with some extra gauge fixing, we might have some hope of recovering, of getting rid of those terms and obtaining, being able to absorb lambda and somehow recover GR at least for lambda over 1/3. Below 1/3, I think it's very unlikely. But we haven't been able to do so. Just as an extra remark, whatever deviation we have here has nothing to do with extra degrees of freedom. So we do have six first class constraints, the same ones we have in GR, the phi I and the Hi, which just reflects the fact, again, that we did not touch spatial diffeomorphisms. And just as a note, because this quaternary constraint depends on the lapse, one actually has to redefine the momentum constraint in order to make it first class. Otherwise, we'd get some odd number of second class constraints, just because we didn't take into account that it should generate the lead derivative also on lapse and phi. And again, this definition is this equivalent on the constraint surface, so it's perfectly fine. And then we have four second class constraints, h, pi minus a square root of g, phi, and m, where these two are a pair and these two as well. The conclusion is that actually we have only two physical degrees of freedom, just like in GR. But first, we don't have the same set of symmetries. We don't even have the most general action for that set of symmetries. So the usual no-go theorems don't hold here. And
in the projectable case, we have this issue of extra scale
and order. Yeah, on the projectable case, the issue is that the Hamiltonian constraint is an integrated one. So this, usually the computation you do counts for local degrees of freedom. There you have global constraints, you have some fields which are defined globally. So I'm not exactly sure how I would count. So there I think it's safe to say that you do have some scalar. And we actually tried to reproduce the results by Kiefer and Giulini in this version of the theory. So just try to blindly compute the acceleration of the tree volume. And while it does have the same prefactor, it also has the r minus 3 lambda term. But first, the equation that constrains the lapse is lambda dependent. So since this whole thing depends on n, might be this could cancel some way. And moreover, there is also the alpha dependent term, which since it should be that which determines the foliation, point is, we cannot really reach the conclusion that the acceleration of the volume does change, the sign changes when we go below 1/3. Now, this was computed with the simpler case of A being a constant. And it's also not possible to just go here and set this one to 1 and this one to 0. Well, we can do that, but then the solution of M actually implies that these things here depend on lambda and would partially cancel these, not completely. So conclusion here is that, the idea that this version of the theory for the non-projectable parts does not depend on lambda was a happy coincidence for the fact that we were working with asymptotically flat surfaces. For the compact case that we studied, it becomes a lot more subtle. We would still have to perform more computations with different choices of A and actually get some observables to be able to actually understand the lambda dependence. It's clear that it's still there, but we haven't been able, outside the fact that under 1/3 it does create some problems with the phase space, to actually quantify this dependence. However, on the projectable case, since the lapse is a function of time, its momentum is a function of time, and preserving the phi equals zero constraint yields an integrated Hamiltonian. Again, when we start to preserve this guy, nothing wrong happens because here there is no smearing, and in the total Hamiltonian, the smearing function is a function of time. Hence, that variation I mentioned before just vanishes. And Because of that, we're actually free to work with laps being equal to 1, which we weren't able in the non-projectable case, and with the shift being 0. In that case, I mean, this list of conditions is essentially all the assumptions they made, which were completely unrelated to Ojeda Lifshitz as far as they were concerned, to deduce this. So actually, this is just, if we one on the projectable theory disregards all the higher order terms, all the constraints that they obtain are perfectly applicable there. And so there was essentially no contradiction, just a mismatch of which version one was working with. So we get to the conclusion. So again, the action we analyzed was this one, so where every time it was asymptotically flat, this term was not here. And it's just the Einstein-Hilbert action with the lambda modification. So the results and the restrictions that came already from the 90s that show that lambda could not be very different from 1, they are a characteristic of the feature of the projectable theory. For the non-projectable setting, we obtain a tertiary constraint, the one here. For we studied the compact case, which was, as far as we know, was new, and we obtain essentially the CMC gauge condition. However, since pi does not vanish, we cannot make lambda disappear completely from the theory. And as at least, unless there is some smart choice of gauge, of some remaining gauge that we missed, then we do not recover GR. For the simpler case of this A here being a constant, which is, as far as I know, not very used in GR choices, but it's a solution for this, so why not test the simpler phase space solution we have? Then it seems, I think it's very reasonable to say that lambda below 1/3 implies that the phase space will be different from the one of general relativity, and therefore there the theory will just not be the same. For above 1/3, might have some hope of somehow absorbing lambda in either A or the cosmological constant or a combination of both. Now, we are not free in general to fix N because of the quaternary constraint, and the foliation is actually determined by this constraint in a lambda-dependent way. However, the theory only has 2 local degrees of freedom, which is, at least for me, it's interesting. So the idea would be that if we broke diffeomorphism symmetry, that necessarily would lead to the presence of scalar modes and so on. But because we are not dealing with the most general action that we can build out of theory, just the lower order one, we actually have only 2 local degrees of freedom, so at least some hope of perhaps recovering GR. One of the interesting things is that for in shape dynamics, the way they establish the equivalence with GR, it's actually with gauge-fixed versions of GR, at least as far as I understand. And the gauge-fixed versions they use are the ones that were naturally led to by the constraint algebra. In particular, for the compact case, they have the CMC gauge condition, and for the asymptotically flat, they have the maximum slicing gauge. So perhaps as a future project would be interesting to see if there is any connection between the theories. If, for example, one can do the same procedure of departing that they do from departing from GR arriving in shape dynamics, but from this version of Ojeda Lifshitz, perhaps even including higher order terms. And, well, that's it. Thanks for your attention.
So is there any phenomenology that you can do on this lambda?
I hope so.
Or did anybody look into this?
Well, you know that there are like 500 papers on the first year or so of the theory. I'm pretty sure people looked into it, but a lot of it was just assuming specific flows for lambda and then computing stuff without taking into account that, well, you're actually forced to work in certain conditions like the ones we showed here. I would like to eventually start computing more observables, but I'm kind of studying numerical relativity at the moment to hope to be able to do so. But I hope to be able to do something, but I haven't done it yet.
Questions?
Yeah. So if you try to draw some knowledge from the perturbative analysis, the version of the theory you're considering, when you're sending this acceleration, you're not including the acceleration term,
yes,
which is equivalent to sending its coefficient to 0,
yes,
right? And you look at the perturbative analysis around flat space of this theory, it just tells you that the scalar mode that you had when C14 was not 0 now has to propagate infinitely fast. So okay. It satisfies an elliptic equation. So you don't find it as a propagating mode in your non-perturbative analysis because it has become instantaneous, I guess. It's not a...
So you're saying that the scalar mode comes from the acceleration things on the action?
I'm saying that if you take the coefficient of the acceleration term in the action to zero,
mm-hmm.
and you do that in general analysis without having this coefficient zero, you see that when you send it to zero, the speed of propagation of this scalar mode in flat space just diverges.
Okay.
So the mode becomes infinitely fast in that limit, right? And so to the level you can draw some inspiration from this analysis, you expect that this mode essentially turns elliptic on you. The equation doesn't have any time derivatives anymore. It's just determined by boundary data. So I think this is why you're losing it also in the Hamiltonian analysis, essentially. It's the non-perturbative.
Well, I'm just not... analysis. Okay.
That's why you find the same number of modes in GR when you don't include this term. But that's very, very particular.
So as soon as I include I would expect something to happen to spoil this thing when I include them.
But that's still not GR, right? Just because you don't have the same, that's because you have the same number.
I'm not claiming it's GR. For asymptotically flat, it is, but that's just because already you were setting the mode that lambda is controlling to zero at the boundary. And just the constraint made sure it propagated for the entire hypersurface. But it's just a happy, I think it stems more from boundary conditions than from the actual theory being GR.
I'm not even sure that that is true because, this person here, for instance, has looked into this theory and has found black hole solutions different than GR for C14 is equal to zero in a fully non-perturbative analysis. So it can be the same theory.
Hmm. I think some part of the assumptions that you do while deriving this is that you cannot have any point where the lapse vanishes. So usually with singularities, that's not true. So the analysis does not include these kind of situations.
So this is an interesting point. So you're saying that there are asymptotically flat solutions that are different from GR?
In the C14 equals zero case.
In the?
The acceleration not being there. Yeah, yeah.
And with,
you found the solution, right?
And with a spherical symmetry?
Yeah.
Okay.
And those collapse solutions that you have studied reduces to these solutions. Like with the
U. But they are... But they are like GR in the sense that if you turn on the gravity of the ether field, then it's not going to be asymptotic with that. So that's the we didn't turn on the gravity of the ether field, so there was no back reaction. But if you do have back reaction, then I don't think you can have asymptotic graphs. But I don't know. So I guess that there is some contradictory statement. So
what assumptions did you have on your model when you got these black hole solutions?
Well, it wasn't really in propagation study. It was more like studying static solutions.
Okay.
With precisely setting this coefficient, which you call beta, I guess,
yeah,
to zero.
And with the non-projectable version.
The non-projectable version. But even though you send this term, you don't have this term in the Lagrangian, ether still can have an acceleration.
Okay.
Way back the non-projectable case without the acceleration term was shown to be strongly coupled in perturbation theory around flat space.
As far as I know, that assumes a specific flow of lambda. Now, the as far as I remember, those papers, all of them assumed specific flows for this parameter lambda. So the way the parameter flows to the infrared was actually a part of the assumptions.
Well, I mean, it was just a particular value of lambda.
I think
it was just fixing lambda.
I think they assumed that lambda was flowing to 1 on the infrared. And so at least for the synthetically flat case, I think the assumption is not really justified.
Any value of lambda, that was the claim. But that was a claim which misguided. I don't know, it might sound, somebody might have heard me say this. So if you have a degree of freedom which has infinite speed of propagation, it doesn't make sense to quantize it. So
I'm not even talking about quantum theory, just the classical behavior of that field theory I thought was strong.
So what do you mean by a strongly coupled then?
Tendency to perturbative.
You mean perturbation. Okay, so that's the thing. So they were trying to perturb around the background that is not constantly in curvature. But if there is nothing,
Right.
But then globally, we know that the only consistent backgrounds are the ones that are constant in curvature. And those, then there's nothing wrong. You just have elliptic equations.
How do we know that the only consistent backgrounds are the ones that are constant in curvature?
I assume you've already shown that.
It's the only solution for the constrained algebra, for example.
Oh, you mean within this
algebra? Yeah, within this, yeah.
Okay. I'll have to look at that. But also, with William Donnelly, I wrote a paper on the Hamiltonian formulation of the theory of the non-projectable theory with the acceleration term.
Okay.
I think we considered everything. I mean, we fully analyzed the compact case.
How long ago was this paper?
A few years ago.
I think I've missed it, which is a shame. Take a look into that.
It was after the Bellerin and Restucci.
Mm-hmm. So you included the acceleration term as well?
Yeah.
And what were the conclusions?
We showed the constraints are first class, exactly which symmetries are preserved, what the phase space looks like.
Did you manage to obtain any constraints on the value of lambda and beta, well, what I called beta, the couplings,
no,
to reproduce GR? Or?
No. But we should talk about it.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, if that's not the case, then it's time to speak her again.